All right, so why don't you introduce yourself and tell me your name and when and where you were born?
Okay, I'm Bill Hairston. Call myself W.I. Bill Hairston. That's to distinguish me from the other nine Bill Hairstons that are in this three-county area. So I'm W.I. Bill Hairston. I was born actually on the road in Phenix City, Alabama. My father was in the service at Fort Benning. We lived across the road. That's a story in itself. I was born during a flood and all that, but we won't get to there. We moved to St. Albans, West Virginia at age 11, 1960. And I became part of in the fabric of the Coal River and the rural part of St. Albans before homes and all that were built, et cetera. So I'm one of those country kids from out on Coal River.
Why don't you tell me a little bit about your family background?
Well, my mother was from rural Alabama, a little place called Seal, Alabama. It's in Russell County. And like I said, Russell County is directly across the Chattahoochee River from the second largest town in Georgia, which is Columbus, and Fort Benning, Georgia, which is there. So she was born there. My father was born in McDowell County. He was born, my grandfather had moved there and was working the coal mines, and my father, of course, was born there and received his education through the seventh grade in McDowell County, and then he joined the service. He was actually 16, and he was supposed to be 17, but that, again, is a story. Within, I don't want to get good on these rabbit holes right, with all these different stories. But and then they met while he was in the Army. He was at Fort Benning. They met and eventually had me and had my little sister. And my mother was a widower with already one child, so... So there were three of us running around. So,
tell me about growing up in St. Albans.
Absolutely. Well, when I think about it now, it's wonderful. Wasn't then. It was a community that was predominantly white. Actually, most of West Virginia is predominantly white. But this was different from, say, the Charleston or even in-town St. Albans. We were one of maybe three families out our way. If you know where Strawberry Road is, you go down Strawberry Road on the Coal River, following the Coal River, and you get to what's called Fairview Drive. It's called Fairview Drive now. Back then it was called Lickskillet. And you go in the Lickskillet, and that's the area that I come from. So therefore, I grew up with, went to school and grew up with pretty much your standard West Virginian. You know, we were the folks that played the music, did the storytelling on the porches, tried to take care of our kids. We played all day and slept at night like we ate the beans and all the different kinds of things that you talk about, except ramps. We never had ramps. That came to me later, but it was just a good, solid existence where we were part of the community and it just worked. It was happening, ironically, in the 60s when the whole country was sort of stirring up, particularly around black and white issues. And to a large extent, Lickskillet missed a lot of that. They just did. Now, as I left Lickskillet, I started experiencing all kinds of things. But for whatever the reason, and I think it was because we were in such a small minority in the community, that we just either didn't notice it or I'm sure it was there, you know, but we missed a lot of it. But you could see it on TV when we finally got our TV. And by the time I got to high school, it was strong. The whole tensions around race and around this country and all the things that were happening. So.
So you were one of three black families on Lickskillet?
Yes, three families in Lickskillet. Now, I have to make that clear. There are other parts of St. Albans, but in Lickskillet, where we were from, we were part of three, and I would say that there must have been, I don't know, 30, 35, nobody really counted, but we were less than 10% of the residents in the area. So
were your parents musicians?
My grandfather played banjo. My mother was a vocalist and church singing vocalist kind of thing. My father, no. He never, to this day, I don't know of him ever even picking up an instrument or trying it, or even, I think he took us to a couple of local events, you know, around town, but that was probably because his buddies were there with other recreational things. But no, my grandfather had stopped playing banjo by the time we got there, but we knew he did. And you'd ask him questions, and he this is going back down into McDowell County, they would play for dances and that kind of thing, front porch get-togethers, you know, that kind of stuff. So that's but no, by the time that my father came along, that was just not an interest of his. He had no interest whatsoever as far as being a musician, you know.
What was your grandfather's name?
Colonel Isaac Hairston. Colonel was his first name, not his army designation, but he was Colonel Isaac. I am William Isaac. My father was actually Odell Isaac, which was ugly, but he would sometimes use William, you know. But he was, my grandfather would always say, "You're Odell. You're named after your uncle." So he would have to fess up. And the part Isaac comes out of a tradition within the family, all the way back to my great grandfather. So.
What was your initial interest in traditional music and folklore?
Well, this will take a second.
Okay.
I was active in 4-H, being from where I was from, et cetera. And so I ended up in 4-H camp. And in 4-H camp, every now and then, some musician would come around. It seemed as though I just connected to those guys. I wasn't playing or anything, I just connected. I had a mentor, a woman that I had met in 4-H camp, of all places, who was very, very interested in all facets of folklore and folk life, et cetera. She worked actually for what they call the Department of Commerce at that time. She was one of the people initially that started the Mountain Arts and Crafts Fair at Cedar Lake. So she was one of those. But little by little, she started introducing me to this and that and different music, particularly starting with Scottish kind of thing. She believed, and it later on turned out right, that there was a Scottish background within the Hairston family. I don't know where she got that or why she knew that, but she continually told me. And so I literally would be involved in even Scottish dance. I you know, it's a long story, but in my first year at Glenville State College, I was asked to come to what they called Mountain Heritage Weekend. Now, my role there was to do what they called a Cayley in the evening. That was where all the musicians and the storytellers and the poets, everybody that was there for the weekend sharing with the participant came together and shared something. And I was to be the one that emceed it and coordinated it and put it together. So I was 18-year-old, and that was going to be my role. At that point in time, that was funded by there was no Division of Culture and History, but whatever was there at first, Norman Fagan, yeah. And so it was done by the Extension Service, WVU Extension Service, and they did these for children, mostly junior high school children, and adults, different adult groups. So I ended up going, I don't know, maybe 8-9 times a year, traveling around the state in different places in these heritage weekends and doing that same thing. In doing that, I started meeting musicians. If you remember, back in 4-H camp, I was already sort of attracted to these musicians that would show up and do this or that. Well, here all of a sudden, I was spending weekends with some of the most interesting people to me that I could possibly think of. A lot of them are dead now, but you know, that's where I met originally the Morris brothers. David had just gotten back from Vietnam, and John was doing his thing, and they were invited to one of those weekends. That's where Lee. Oh, there's so many. Lee Triplett. I can go on with names, but and so during that period of time, I met musician after musician, writer after writer, folks, scholars from WVU that would come down and do this or that, singers, et cetera, and I just simply befriended them. I ended up other weekends visiting them. I visited everybody all the time. Every weekend I was going somewhere and dragging somebody along with me while I went off to Clay County or where I went off to wherever. And just that overall experience brought me to an appreciation not only of the music. By the way, I was asked to come and be a part of what was the Negro spirituals, to sort of interpret that as a part of that weekend, but also to do those Kaylees, et cetera. And so I just found myself deeply involved in all kinds of things, to a point that before, as life moved on, I was part of the Arts and Crafts Fair at Cedar Lakes. I was part of several different events. And then one year, I was probably, I'd say 22, and they were having a music festival. And this was not Ivydale, this was on up the road from Ivydale. I'm trying to remember the name of the town. Was before Gandyville, right in there they had a festival.
In Clay County.
It was, it might come to me in a second. But I slept underneath my van. I was pure hippie by then. I mean, there was no doubt about it. I was pure hippie. I was the kid that got a job at Department of Natural Resources in the summertime, and they would give you a state car so you could go around and do what you had to do. And there would be all these calls and complaints from all these different places, Wayne County and Pocahontas County, et cetera, that there's this black guy who doesn't wear shoes who has stole one of the state cars. and it just kept happening over and over. Because people saw this guy with all the hair and the cutoff jeans and no shoes and whatever, and he couldn't possibly really be working for the state of West Virginia. But I was. But now I've forgotten where I was. Okay. You'd asked me, what was your question?
Well, it was just your initial interest.
Oh, okay.
And you were talking about
the festival. And so, oh yeah, I was going to tell you about the festival. I was asleep underneath my van is where I slept. I didn't have a tent or anything. And this little boy and his father came over and started talking to me, woke me up. And it turned out to be Kenny Parker. Kenny Parker, who had a deep interest in traditional music, finally started a group at Stonewall Jackson Jubilee about 45 years ago. And he asked me if I wouldn't come up and help with that event. And so I started going up and helping to coordinate music at the Stonewall Jackson Jubilee. And we were traditional music, all totally. That's what we did. Even the bluegrass folks came in and they'd have to do, you know. And so over those years, and with all my interest and all my exposure, I doubt seriously if there's a traditional musician that exists in West Virginia now that I haven't experienced, no personally, or sang with, at one point even played with. I ended up on an auto harp, and I don't really do that anymore, but who I've been a part of, you know, and just like weekends like last weekend and other weekends where you just run into people that you've known for over 45 years, you know, just in music. So that's essentially who I am. Now, as a part of all of that, I started reading, I started studying, I started interviewing people, et cetera. And so I have this sort of vast knowledge of folklore and folk life in West Virginia. You know, I've experienced like I said, I visit everybody, and I've been in some places probably, particularly in the 60s and 70s, where it might not have been wise for a young black man to go, but my interest sort of overtook that. Mm-hmm. And
what were those places?
Well, Clay County, lots of great, great people down there. Let's see, up there around Calhoun County, where Phoebe Parsons and going blank on names where they were. What's his name? Well, she too, I knew. Even younger people like down there in Summers County, Jimmy Costa. We went into one area, and when I say we, I met Jane George and Frank George. I not only visited them, I stayed with them every chance I got. And so I spent tremendous hours with them I traveled with them. They were on their way to some event or some place, and I just drove down to wherever they were. At this time, mostly either Putnam County, then they moved to Mercer County, and I just drive and hop in the car and go with them wherever they went. And again, picking up on the music, picking up on the people, picking up on the culture. And it's a culture that I didn't get to West Virginia until I was 11 years old. And so I had a real strong understanding of being a young black kid in Alabama. And all of a sudden I lost it immediately when we got to West Virginia. It was gone. I mean, Alabama, even though I was less than 11, Alabama, I went all day not really talking to anybody white or see them on the street, see them in a car, but my doctor, the stores I was in, everybody in the life, the pastor, everybody, and all the people I knew were black. They were, you know, and all of a sudden here I was introduced to rural West Virginia And there were just a few, well, very few blacks. So it was a, I'll give you one example and then I'll, okay. The summer, we got here in June of 1960. So that summer, we were playing with the kids that were in our neighborhood. All the kids, you know, just, we were having, we go places, do things. My little sister and I, by then my older sister had graduated nursing school and was already in Cleveland, Ohio. But we were, just, we had a great summer, our first summer in West Virginia. And it was school time. And that my mother had taken a lot of time teaching us where to go. We in Alabama, in Phoenix City, we didn't have a bus that we had to ride. We just walked to the school, teaching us, actually walking with us to the bus stop, et cetera, so that we were prepared that morning. And we started out, my little sister, who was about a little less than 2 years younger than me, we started out to the bus stop. The white kids were also walking with us to the bus stop. And we said, well, you know, maybe they catch the bus in the same place. So we got to the bus stop and we had the number of the bus and all of that. And when the bus came, the number of the bus, the white kids were getting on the bus. And we thought, well, you know, maybe we all use the same bus to get to our schools. And guess what? When we got to school, they got off and it was the same stop. Nobody had told us that we were going to be in an integrated school. We'd never experienced an integrated school. And here we were standing on the bus or sitting and really the last kids off trying to get that in our minds what was about to happen.
Wow.
And we made it. I was the only black person in my homeroom. That's again another story. But that's one experience I'm talking about of how we had to learn as we went along, you know. And we were real sort of upset with our mother, and she said, "Well, I don't know that she knew that."
Yeah.
You know, I'm not even sure if she knew that, but it was what it was,
yeah.
You know.
When, so, Brown v. Board was 58?
55.
Mm-hmm.
And West Virginia integrated schools immediately. Okay. 54, come to think of it, because my mother-in-law, it was 54 because my mother-in-law was, in Kanawha County, they started integration, I guess, that next year in 55, that fall of 55 or 54, I'm not sure what, by staggering classes. In other words, the first grade was integrated, the second grade was still black, the third grade was integrated, et cetera. And they went through the whole system in Kanawha County that way so that it would be easy. 1 year later, everybody was integrated. So my mother-in-law was one of those that was put in a integrated school the first year, and she has all these stories about that. But by the time we got here, that was six years later, and integration was solid in Kanawha County. Now, I have to say that. Some of the other counties, McDowell County, Raleigh County, I know all this because obviously I've read it all, but I know that. 68 was the year. I mean, way into, now we're talking about 1954.
Yeah.
Raleigh County was, or McDowell County was 68. Raleigh was right in there somewhere, and some of those other counties. There were also counties, ironically, that had such few black children in it, being West Virginia, and also having such low budgets and not having a lot of money, because what you do was to send your children, or the county school board would send the black children into the next county or two counties over or whatever, where there was a black high school. That's just what they did. But in some of these counties, they couldn't afford the transportation, for instance, if you were in high school, you were probably, unless you were in Kanawha or Cabell or one of the southern counties, you were a resident. If you're going to go to high school, you were a resident in some school. West Virginia State College had its own high school where kids were sent from all over the state. And that was the same in some of the other schools. But so what I'm saying is there were kids that were, there was such a low amount of black children in the county with not enough money to transport them, et cetera, into the next county or even have a school, that they just put them in the school. So you have some, and I don't know, I've been meaning for years to take a look at that, but most of those counties were above, say, Gilmer, and out to east of Gilmer over in that area. But they just didn't have the money, so they just, the heck with segregation, they law said you had to educate this kid, so they educated the kid. So, but now you see, I've forgotten where I was again.
You were talking about how there just wasn't really a black community. You had a real strong sense of black community in Alabama.
I had that, and that left here. And I think because of that, that was my struggle. I was trying my best to identify with my family, my Hairston family, which at that time I didn't really have a good understanding of. I just knew that they were from McDowell County. I knew very little about them, but I knew, remember, the banjo was at my grandfather's house. And so that was that connection. And so I think a lot of what happened to me, a lot of my interest and understandings and zest to learn came out of a desire to just identify. And so, and of course, I'm way of age now. I identify with everything. I know what's going on, you know, et cetera. You know, but it's that struggle back in the 20s in particular, because high school sort of was its own thing. That's a whole different kind of life. But to end up at Glenville State College, to go back that summer to the place where I went to school and see the West Virginia Folk Festival and see all of these people and all these musicians, none of which back then were black, but still fascinating. And so I just hooked on to that. At the same time, I was hooking on to black traditions. Still to this day, you know, I can be at the Glenville State Folk Festival one day, and then back here in Charleston, singing with Martin Luther King Jr. male chorus in a little African American church, just enjoying that. I'd learned to do that. My son, who grew up traveling with me, is a kid that can blend into any kind of situation. There's been weeks that we went to Alabama for, say, a family reunion, and then went to maybe the Stonewall Jackson Jubilee, and then got invited to the Rockefeller compound, because that's something else. I used to be heavily involved politically. And my child could just adjust from being that kid in Alabama with them to the rural families to these other families. He still does that even today. So it worked out. So.
What about Uncle Homer Walker? Did you really latch on to him?
Yes, we did. I followed Jane and Frank George almost to whatever they were doing. That was just natural for me. I had taken a week off my work, and I had gone down to Princeton, West Virginia, where they were doing a day camp. And this was a day camp for just children in that community. It's a mostly African-American community, in the Princeton area. And so we were just doing the day camp day after day. And one day Frank pulled out his banjo and was just going to do a demonstration for these kids. And he started doing it and teaching them about the banjo, et cetera. And one little girl said, "Uncle Homer has one of those." And we looked at her, and she was an African-American kid. Uncle Homer. Well, there was a this sort of starvation to find black musicians, particularly banjo players. And this little girl was saying, "Uncle Homer." And I looked at Frank. Frank looked at me, and we both looked at Jane, and we said, "Oh, my goodness." We talked to that little girl, found out that her Uncle Homer lived in a little town on the edge of the state, on 460 leaving the state, called Glen Lynn, Virginia. That was all we knew, Glen Lynn, Virginia. And so that very Saturday, we drove down to Glen Lynn, Virginia, and started asking around, "Is there, an Uncle Homer or whatever?" We weren't having much luck at first. And then finally, a guy in a bait and tackle place said, "Hey, Uncle Homer lives up that hill," and blah, blah, blah. So we went up that hill and followed the direction, and there was Uncle Homer sitting on his porch, not playing banjo. That would have been too. He was just sitting on his porch, just enjoying the afternoon. And we introduced ourselves and talked to him for a while. And, "I understand you play banjo." He said, yeah. And eventually, he pulled out his banjo. Frank pulled out his banjo, and they started playing. And immediately we brought him to the next festival, because he was ready to go. His board sitting on that porch, and I think the next festival was, I'm not sure which one, but I remember when it was time for Ivydale Festival, Uncle Homer had lost his banjo. And we were so excited about him going. And I was telling John Morris. So John Morris sent me back to Glen Lynn with a banjo for Uncle Homer. And then I drove Uncle Homer up to Ivydale. And that from there, he became this person that, he was so popular that other people invited him to things, and they came and got. Uncle Homer didn't drive, he didn't. But all of a sudden, I was reading about Uncle Homer had been here or there. So, but that all happened because of that little day camp down in Princeton, where the little girl said, "Uncle Homer has one of those." So that was, we found a man, and he had been playing for years. He was one of those guys that he was in his 80s. And he played for dances. He remembered a time when lots of black people played those instruments. I've discovered, and I've been challenged at this, but when radio became really popular, and banjo in particular was picked up by this whole new group of musicians, or they were becoming more popular, the black folks were either overshadowed or just didn't want to play. They didn't want to identify. Mm-hmm. So little by little, like my grandfather, which I finally decided that's why he stopped, they just didn't want to identify, and so that whole thing left. Mm-hmm. And every now and then, even today, you can find a musician. I ran into a guy 2 years ago down in North Carolina. Frank ran into a guy up in the state of Washington. He went up there for a festival that was from Louisiana, but the rural part of Louisiana, great young man. I think we even brought him here at one point. I wasn't in the state then, so I was doing something.
Well, I know you befriended mm-hmm. Jerome Paxton.
Yes, right. And Kim, banjo player Kim Johnson, But Frank was just fascinated by him. When I remember, I was still visiting them. I never stopped. But I remember going up to their house one weekend. Frank had all these tapes and videos and all of this stuff, and he baptized me with this guy for about 2 hours or so. He said, "Now you gotta meet him." And when he came here, I think I was, I believe that I was, I know I was out of state, but I don't remember what it was, but I couldn't be there for him, so.
What do you think some of that was because of the image being put forward? You know, like the way that they separated race records and hillbilly music,
exactly.
So it became affiliated with whiteness?
And once it was affiliated with white, quote, hillbillies, it wasn't attractive, I don't believe, to some blacks. They didn't want to play. They were embarrassed to play at some of them. And to be very honest with you, I think they were discouraged by, you know, you didn't want this black guy at your dance playing. I mean, I really believe that was part of it. Not a huge part, but part of it. So little by little, guys like my granddaddy just sort of put it aside and went on to something else. And that's a sad thing, but it happened.
Yeah.
You know, it did happen.
So you mostly played auto harp, or did you?
Yeah, well, what you have to understand is that I kept picking up instruments. My first instrument was the fiddle. I picked it up, and I was hanging around with folks that could just unbelievably play fiddle. I mean, great. So I ended up, either they didn't want me to play or I didn't want to play. So I left the fiddle alone. And then I picked up the guitar, which is basic. But still, the folks that I was running with, different people or same people in some cases, they were just so much better that I would put it aside and do what I did well, and that was vocal, and run my mouth, and et cetera, et cetera. And I never got that. And finally, I tried the banjo, and I couldn't do it, period. The other two, there was that possibility, but the banjo, I couldn't get it.
Yeah.
So then along comes this auto harp, which was just downright easy. There was nothing to it. And so I started playing auto harp, and I played with groups, et cetera, et cetera. And I did it on my own. I even had a point in time when I was just going out to Holiday Inns up and down 81, playing music on me and my auto harp. But I remember I also had my mouth, and I had stories. I could capture that audience, and they paid me to do that. So hey, why not? You know. And even the last few years, I haven't done a lot with auto harp, but I'm getting back to it. I pulled it out. The music that I used to do basically was really traditional tunes, songs, things taught to me by people like Aunt Jenny Wilson down in, I Wish I Was Single Again, I Wish I Was Single. And just over the years, that's not what people want me to do. And so I just, and as the years passed, particularly the last 10, maybe even 15, but particularly the last 10, people identify me as a storyteller, which is fine because I am. Mm-hmm. And that's what they invite me to do. They aren't inviting me to sing or play music. Mm-hmm. They're either inviting me to be a storyteller or to MC the event that's going on. So I ended up MCing a lot. And that's because of Stonewall Jackson Jubilee and other places. So I've become this person who's an MC storyteller who sings, and I guess that's who I'll be for a long time, you know, so. Mm-hmm.
Was there any reaction to you as this hippie black kid from some of the people you were going to visit?
actually, let me see how I can put this. Simplistic. People are very simplistic. I won't call names, but let me just say that I would go to visit a person, and they could very well see that I was a black kid. And because I think because of their inner nature of just being good people, they immediately put up with this black kid that they didn't know. They might have even been uncomfortable, I'm not sure. But I used to get phrases like, you're really a good kid, even though you are Negro or colored, was mostly. And so what they were doing was getting to know me, and even though they had their own prejudices and misunderstandings, et cetera, people, because some of these people, you know, just never left their homes except, you know, they were accepting me because I was a good person, even though I was colored, you know, kind of thing. That, and I guess that's the attitude that will sum it up. They thought I was a good person or a good kid in a lot of cases, or whatever, because even though I was colored. Mm-hmm. You know. Now, that they would not, well, they wouldn't say that now in this day and age. They probably will as time goes on. Well, maybe I better not. I'm not going there. But yeah. So if you ask me, there were incidences that I experienced where people would react to this black person by either, believe it or not, getting up and leaving, being bold and calling me the N-word. That happened over the years a few times. One of my stories, which is very long, is a story of an incident that happened to me simply because I was, in fact, black. And what people forget is that's not something that happened in big cities or whatever. It happened here. It happened. I was a kid I will mention it. I was a kid that in my early years, in my 20s, I wouldn't even drive in the city of South Charleston because I was pulled over for no reason. Here I was a state employee working for natural resources, a college student, a good kid, you know, and I was being pulled over. So I would, to go to St. Albans, I would go the other way down through Institute and Dunbar and across the Nitro Bridge just to get away from the hassle of being pulled over. The answer is, and I would never ever say that West Virginians are without a doubt the most, and I've heard people say this, we don't have prejudices here, et cetera. That's all a bunch of hogwash. What I can tell you is that people in West Virginia, particularly rural West Virginians, will size you up before they make their final decision. And just because they make a decision that you are okay, doesn't change who they are and how they see in general pictures. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what I observed as well.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about your development as a storyteller?
Well, back in Alabama, believe it or not, the old folks, the old guys, I should say, the old men would get together there was a one little section that's named after my mother's family now, the Body Avenue, B-O-D-D-I-E. That was her name. But they would get together and just start sharing with each other, and a lot of good stories. And again, you were a kid. That's not something you could participate in, but you were welcome to sit there as they passed the bottle and did all they did and told their story. So that was something that was always there, and I always just have fun just sitting there. Lo and behold, when I get to St. Albans, the same thing was happening on porches, on under trees, wherever they were, it was back then. It was mostly men who were just telling stories and telling some real. I mean, these were tall tales, etc. Where then I started, and that's when it really fascinated me. So in high school, every now and then I'd get an opportunity, and I would try to tell a story. That wasn't something that would work for the talent show at high school. Nobody was interested in anybody telling a story. But I would do it in other places. Then I got an opportunity in church and the MYF. I was a good Methodist kid, and there I could get up and tell stories. And so just little by little, by the time I got to be personality of the Stonewall Jackson Jubilee 44, 45 years ago. I was telling stories while this person was getting ready to play or this band was getting ready to come up or whatever. I was telling stories, little short stories of things that came into my head. And it just built from that. It built to a point where I do concerts. I'm what you call a regional storyteller. I'm not the Bill Lepp that's all over the country doing his thing. Bill Lepp is probably my hero, if I could call him that, along with others. But I'm the regional person. I'm the person that you'll find at the festival in North Carolina or the festival in Kentucky, West Virginia, a little bit. Less in West Virginia than, say, in Kentucky. I'm a member of the West Virginia Storytelling Guild, the Kentucky Storytelling Association, and the Ohio Storytelling Network. Those are my three organizations. And I sort of work out of all those groups and so on. And I have learned to, my stories at one point in time were things that I heard, things that I read. I was picking stories out of books of other storytellers, et cetera. And over the years, it's just become me. And I was at the Folklife Center at Fairmont this weekend. I told a story for the very first time that was totally about a coincidence, I called it. That involved me, so I'm at a point now that the stories are becoming extremely personal. But I'm not. I mean, I can do the funny stuff, and I do it. I have several of those. What you have to do is look at your audience and look at the reaction of your audience, and then choose what you're going to do based on the feedback you're getting or the look you're getting or whatever. So. But that basically, and I forgot the fact that one of my outlets were 4-H. As I came through the 4-H program, I was allowed to tell my stories. So I'm one of these that just all of his life liked the music, but more with the stories, it's something that people did, I enjoyed, and I picked up on, and I'm now able to actually make money doing it. It's great to be able to do what you like. And as a retired person, I was doing it before retirement, but now hey, I can take off on any day of the week and go anywhere. And I've got, I'm scheduled, well, for the next few months, I've got Wednesdays and Thursdays and Tuesdays and et cetera, with everything from libraries to just organizations that it's the one group, I can't even remember the name of them, but, well, I'll be a part of the national 4-H agents meeting down at the Greenbrier in November. What they're doing, people are coming in from all over the country, and they're trying to showcase some of their talent. Mm-hmm. And I guess they consider me one of their talents. Oh, yeah. And so I'll be there. So.
Are you still involved with 4-H? Is that just through Stonewall Jackson Jubilee?
I do. Well, technically, Stonewall Jackson Jubilee wasn't actually 4-H, okay, even though the Extension Service was there and did some things. I, for years, would always do at least two 4-H camps, at least visit two 4-H camps every summer somewhere in the state. As far as locally, I'm on what's called a visiting, what do we call it? Anyway, the local body with Extension Extension Service Committee, maybe that's the name of it. This summer I wasn't able to do anything because I've been traveling. Last summer, I was I gave my services as a storyteller free to places like Ohio County and within the 4-H camp. I support 4-H financially, particularly in scholarships for children. You see, when I was a kid, yeah, my father was an Army retired person, but we didn't have a lot of money, and it took other people that paid for my 4-H camps. The local dairy, which no longer exists here, but they would pay money, not directly to me, but it was that money that paid for me. And to go to state camp, there was always scholarships and money. So as I sit back now, knowing that that's one of the most crucial things in my life as far as leadership development and being who I am. And by the way, friends, of which I have friends 50 plus from the days from 4-H, I don't have any choice but now to put some of my money back into camps and into scholarships for kids in camp. So to answer your question, I'm a part of the West Virginia 4-H All-Stars. And we're service group 2-4-H here in the state. In fact, we have our state meeting in a couple of weekends from now. And I'm a part of the Extension Service Committee locally. And I do, whenever asked and I'm able to, I'll do volunteer efforts, not only in Kanawha County, but across the state, because this is my playground, so to speak, you know, so.
Stories about.
Okay. Question that's asked all the time. You know, what kind of stories do you do? Well, it depends on the audience. Over all of these years, I have developed what I call the personal funny life stories. I have developed the personal stories, period. I have developed Jack Tales. I have developed what you can call running comedy things. I do some folklore. I don't like to do folklore where I'm talking about a particular incident that happened in West Virginia or whatever, but I do a little bit. I've got a really great John Henry story that's about 20 minutes long, but it involves all kinds of things. So I, but they're not about any specific thing, even though now it seems to be I'm calling up on incidents in my life that I think are prophetic or think deserve to be shared. And I'm starting to go more there than, but if I'm with a child in a children's group, particularly in elementary school, then the stories are gonna be African tales, and they're gonna be tales about genies and you know, just things that, that keeps them involved and keep them making noises and participating in different ways. So, and I do a lot. I do a lot of that, a lot less than I used to, but I'm still doing it. I'll be in Athens next month, and I'll be. I keep thinking I'm somewhere this month, like Gasaway or somewhere. But so to answer your questions, all kinds, different topics, different tale. And it really does depend upon the audience that I'm in front of. I have been called on in corporations, small corporations, where they're trying to build a community of new management, where they either combined with another organization or combined two. And so now these people don't know each other, management folks don't know each other. And I'm invited to come in one evening, tell stories, and do it in such a way that then I get them telling their stories. And then they start sharing with each other. And it makes for a closer net group of managers. Mm-hmm. And the first time I did that, I thought, huh? You know? But then again, all you gotta do is read and research or whatever. And I got it. Figured out how I would do it, and it worked the first time. So I do all of that, and I'm trying to think of some other. But you can find me even emceeing a banquet, the Greene County, Pennsylvania, Yucatan Club or whatever, and I'm there. I'm the speaker for the evening, mm-hmm. and my job is to speak. Kellogg Foundation, if they come through, they were actually in Morgantown, I think, a whole group, and I was that evening's entertainment. So it just depends on where you are and what you're doing. But I'm open for anything as long as it's about the story. Mm-hmm. And I'm open to go anywhere if it's about story. I'm open to work with people. I have workshops that I do on story. The one that's popular now is one I call It Is All About Me. But it's just a workshop that teaches you, not just as a storyteller, but as a person who has to be in front of a group of people and speak, how to keep their attention, what you do and what you don't do, and how and learn and understand what it is to be a communicator in front of people. And so that's what that's all about. It's 90 minutes, and when you leave, hopefully you've got some things under your belt that you can use. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so.
Do you feel like you have any goals or missions as a storyteller, like with bringing African stories to kids, introducing them to more cultural diversity, or are there stories you want to remain in circulation?
If you see my promotions, it says that Bill Hairston combines the I don't even remember, but I'll just say it. He combines the Appalachian culture that he was exposed to on the Coal River to the African American culture that he is a part of. So one of the things that I'm always doing, particularly with children and also with adults, without saying it, is putting together a storyline where it then makes the person understand that the culture, the Appalachian culture that you're sitting in, down in Monroe County, or up in Gilmer County or wherever, isn't that different from the African American culture, as far as the expectations, as far as the people, as far as the food, et cetera. And I try to do that. So yeah, I'm always about combining, or at least bringing people. Over the years, I've been in a lot of situations where I was it. I was the only black person in a 100-mile radius. I'll never forget years ago, not that many years ago,